Now, as I mentioned to you, land use change as a driver of global change is a theme for several talks in this symposium. Our next two speakers are going to examine the role of agriculture as a major driver of global land use change. And the first one is Dr. Navin Ravenkutty, who is an assistant professor in the Department of Geography, where he holds a Canada Research Chair in land use and land cover change. And his research aims to understand how patterns of human land use activities change through time and the ecosystem level impacts of these changes. His presentation today will focus on the environmental trade-offs in agricultural land use.
Thanks, Tony. So as Tony said, my research program tries to understand how humans change the land on global scales and its Earth system implications. So the easiest way I explain what I do is that I study land use change just as climate scientists study climate change using sort of global Earth observations and using global models. Today I'm going to focus my talk on one specific aspect of my research, a major aspect of my research, which is looking at the role of agriculture in sort of modifying Earth system consequences. So just to summarize with, agriculture is a major global environmental problem. It contributes roughly 34% of the global land surface today is occupied by croplands or grazing lands. 20 to 30% of global greenhouse gas emissions comes from agriculture. Typically, when we think about climate change, we think about industries and transportation, but agriculture is a major driver or changes in land cover for agriculture. 70% of global freshwater withdrawals is for agriculture and 85% of consumption. If you think about biodiversity, 37% of threats to birds, which is probably the best-known taxa, is because of agriculture. It's also a major, probably the single largest driver of freshwater and coastal eutrophication. So it's a major driver of global environmental change. If you think about the, if you go back to the planetary boundaries image that Tony presented earlier, if you look at each of those elements, a major driver comes from agriculture. But agriculture also provides food, and so one of the my feeling is that one of the big challenges that we'll face in this century and the next century is sort of managing the trade-offs between feeding people while minimizing agriculture's environmental consequences. So one of the things I do in my research group is trying to use sort of global observations to map agriculture and its use around the planet. And some of the data sets and maps that we make look like this. This is from some of our most recent work looking at the state of the agriculture in the year 2000, and we've developed statistical methods to combine both satellite-derived information on what the world looks like as well as a compilation of census statistics from around the world at the national level, subnational levels, going down to the county level in some regions, for example. And we developed statistical methods to say, okay, we know what agriculture looks like from remote sensing, we know what it looks like from the ground, let's combine them and make maps like this. So this map shows in the green colors places which are used for croplands, and the darker intensity of colors shows areas which have greater extent of croplands, and sort of the brownish colors are places that are used for grazing lands. And together, 34% of the land surface, ice-free land surface, not including Greenland and Antarctica, is used for cultivation or grazing. We further try to see how this change has happened over time. So this is an animation going back to 1700, and we use historical census statistics to do this, make this kind of data set. And it shows going back to 1700, first agriculture in the eastern seaboards of North America, and you'll see it migrating westward with time with European settlement. In the 1860s, you start to see agriculture in eastern Australia. In the 1900s, the Pampas region in Argentina was developed. And in the last 50 years, you'll see huge expansion in Brazil. So this portrays how agriculture looks like today and how it's changed dramatically over the last 300 years. And so these kinds of data sets, we use them within models to look at impacts on carbon cycling, on hydrology and climate and so on. But I'm not going to talk about that. I'm going to talk about what does this mean. Part of the so far I've focused on talking about land cover, but part of what's going on today is that the way we manage the land is also changing, and it's maybe changing even more dramatically. If you look at data on how agriculture has changed since 1961, and this is data from the Food and Agricultural Organization, going all the data are indexed to 1960. If you look at changes in harvested or cropland area, it's changed very little, maybe by 20% or so. But if you look at food production, it's increased by more than two times. So food production doubled, but changes in land area did not double that much. And if you look at what's really gone on, irrigation also doubled over the same time period, and fertilizer use quadrupled over the same time period. So most of our increase in food production over the last 30 years has not come from expanding cropland area, but it's come from intensification of cropland area. That is, with the same amount of land, we are squeezing more and more food out of it by adding more inputs, by adding more water, adding more nutrients. And so to try to understand this, we are also trying to map on a global scale what agriculture looks like in more detail, looking at management practices, what kinds of crops are grown, what kind of inputs go into it, and so on. So one of my former master's students, Chad Manfreda, developed this global database of areas and yields for 175 different crops of the world. And I'm showing just two examples here. The top one shows for maize area on the left-hand side and yields in tons per hectare on the right-hand side. And the bottom, you see soybean areas. So if you look at maize, for example, we grow maize in many parts of the world. It's one of the most ubiquitous crops. But if you look at yields of maize, you compare North America to, say, South America, you see that the highest yields of maize are found in the Midwestern U.S. or in Western Europe because we use a lot of inputs. Maize yields are fairly low in the tropics and the southern countries. But if you look at soybeans, which is expanding quite rapidly today in Latin America, soybean area is confined to a few places. The hotspots are mainly grown in the Midwestern U.S., in Latin America, and India. But if you look at yields of soybean in South America today, they're actually comparable to the yields of yields in Midwestern U.S. So soybean production in South America today uses similar inputs and similar kind of scales of management as in the Midwestern U.S., which is quite remarkable. We've further looked at what does this mean in terms of the number of crops we grow around the world. So we have a database of 175 crops. We then converted them into a measure of agrodiversity using a similar biodiversity index that is commonly used, a modified Simpson's index. So the higher, the darker the colors, the more crops people grow in certain places. So the remarkable thing is that the highest number of the highest diversity of crops occurs in the Andes, parts of the Sahel in Africa and East Africa, as well as in northern northeastern China. But one of the interesting things I found in this map is there's a big difference between North America and Europe. In Europe, we still continue to have a higher diversity of crops, but in North America, we essentially grow two to three crops. Most of the land's covered by soy and corn. And maybe alfalfa. So what is this? This has potential implications not only for what we grow in these places, but also how these crops can withstand shocks in the future. Another kind of work we've been doing is trying to map fertilizer application rates around the world. This is from some former work by a former undergraduate student, Phil Potter, where we mapped, globally we mapped the application rates of nitrogen, phosphorus, and potassium. And again, we saw that agriculture was pretty much covering most of the world, but fertilizer application rates themselves are confined to a few hotspots, places where we know most of the high-intensive agriculture is today, the Western U.S., Midwestern U.S., Western Europe, India, and China. And it turns out that 8.5% of the fertilized croplands today account for 50% of the total amount of nitrogen that's applied on the planet. So fertilizer is really confined to a few places. So if you think about eutrophication problems, for example, it is really confined to a few places where most of the nitrogen fertilizer or phosphorus fertilizer application occurs. And then finally, we can ask, what do we use this land for? So all of this land is, we think, is being used for growing food, right? So this shows two maps. On the top, it shows the percentage of total cropland used for food, and the bottom one shows the percentage used for feed. And the darker colors show higher percentages. And if you look at the percentage used for food, most of the places like India and China still use a lot of their cropland for food. But if you look in Europe and North America, most of they're in lighter colors. And why is that? If you look in this bottom graph, you see that most of those places use their croplands for growing feed, for feeding animals. So yes, we then eat the animals, but there's a loss of efficiency. We only get about 10% of the calories back when we eat animals. Good example is the Midwestern U.S. If you look at the corn production in the U.S. and ask, you know, what happens to it, 67% of the corn produced in some of the best climate and the best soils in the Midwestern U.S. goes for feeding animals. It's animal feed. About 20% is exported. So very little is actually used to produce food. And this is something we should think about. So farming, on the one hand, you know, it feeds 6 billion people, and we may need to feed 9 billion people in the future. Provides livelihood for 65% of the workforce, so it's a huge source of livelihood, and also provides opportunities for development. As countries follow the development pathways, they typically go through the agricultural pathway before they, before they are switched to manufacturing or service industries. On the other hand, as I already said, agriculture is a major global environmental threat. And so balancing this trade-off is going to be a huge challenge. So this brings me to the next kind of aspect of my talk. People have been trying to think about solutions. So intensification is normally presented as one of the ways to meet this challenge. People say, well, in the last 30 years, we have not actually expanded land area. We have intensified production. So maybe that's the way to go, and we can spare land for nature. On the other hand, a lot of ecologists argue that maybe we should practice what they call wildlife-friendly farming. So reduce inputs on the land, but allow a mixture of agriculture and natural areas to coexist and have higher biodiversity. The benefits of land sparing are quite obvious. There's been some retrospective analysis done. This is from the International Food Policy Research Institute, showing four bars here for the world. And so on the darkest bar on the left shows cropland area in 1961. The next one shows cropland area in 2004. So as I already said, cropland areas did not increase. The third one shows the cropland area you would have needed in 2004 if we hadn't increased inputs. Okay, so if you kept the yields constant as at 1961, we may have needed twice as much land in agriculture to produce the same amount of food. And the last bar shows the estimate of total potential area available for agriculture around the planet. Okay, so we might have needed 2.5 billion hectares, and maybe we have 4 billion hectares left. So at the least, it would have meant a huge amount of deforestation would have happened, which we have avoided by intensification. But if you look at the case for Asia, it's even more dire. The third curve, which shows what amount of land area we would have needed without intensification, is actually greater than the estimate of total land area available for production. So essentially, you can argue that the Green Revolution ended up, you know, it allowed for feeding a lot of people in places where we did not have land available for expanding production. So the benefits are very clear. And the benefits of land sparing have been examined in more detail recently by some people in conservation biology looking at the impacts on biodiversity. This is a model presented by Green and colleagues in a paper in Science in 2005. Where they looked at two different hypotheses for how biodiversity might change with intensification of agricultural land. So on the x-axis, you have a gradient of intensification. As you move to the right, there's more and more intensification. And they looked at two different hypotheses. The one is that as you increase the intensity of use of the land, biodiversity does not change very much. That's hypothesis one. And then it crashes at really high levels of biodiversity. Hypothesis two is that biodiversity crashes quite fast as you intensify land, and then it tails off slowly after that. And if you consider these two hypotheses, if you look at hypothesis one, if that's what actually happens in practice, you can say that, well, we can use a lot of land in the intermediate intensity levels, maybe what you might think of as wildlife-friendly farming, without having a huge impact on biodiversity, and you want to avoid places on the extreme right where biodiversity really crashes. On the other hand, if hypothesis two were right, even a little bit of intensification would cause huge crashes in biodiversity, in which case you actually want to keep a lot of your land in pristine nature, so to say, and you want to put a little bit of your land in the extreme right where you have huge amount of yields, but you only devote a little bit of land to that. This is a slightly complex figure to understand, so if you don't follow me, just take my word for it, and we can talk about it more later. But essentially, if hypothesis one is true, it favors extensification or wildlife-friendly farming. If hypothesis two is true, it favors intensification. Then they looked at the actual data, and they said most of the data on biodiversity actually supports hypothesis two, in which case, if you want to preserve biodiversity, we want to intensify landscapes and not do wildlife-friendly farming. So this was their conclusion, saying land sparing is good for biodiversity. But one of the things they did was they did not actually, biodiversity is not the only game in town. There are lots of other environmental issues we should be looking at. And so some of the studies have examined other things. A study by Bernie and colleagues at Stanford looked at implications of land sparing for greenhouse gas emissions. I'll try to simplify this figure and just say what they found is that the real world is on the left-hand side, and the other two are two alternate scenarios where intensification did not happen. So it's a scenario where we expanded land for production. And the bottom line is that if you had not intensified, we would have actually emitted more greenhouse gas emissions over the last 30 years because we would have deforested more land, we would have used more land for rice, which is a big emitter of methane and so on. So the reduction in fertilizer emissions is more than compensated by the increase in carbon dioxide emissions from deforestation. Now let's look at another one, water quality. What happens with intensification? This is a study by two of my former colleagues at Wisconsin showing that if you apply more and more fertilizer on the landscape, water nitrate leaching increases quite fairly exponentially. And so if you invert that and look at, express that as water quality will degrade quite slowly at the beginning, but then it will crash. And so if you apply the same kind of rule as in the green model, extensification in this case is favored by water quality. So it's not clear. If you look at these two hypotheses, if you think about water quality or maybe even soil erosion, if you care about those issues, wildlife-friendly farming is better. If you care about biodiversity or CO2 emissions, maybe intensification is better. So there is no clear picture on which way to go. And that's just summarizing those things. I use the title, you spare the land, you may spoil the water. Extensification leads to biodiversity loss, which is hugely impacted by agriculture. But intensification may lead to nitrogen and phosphorus pollution of waters. So you gain one thing, but you lose something else. So what's the way forward? We need to think about this as a global problem. In the tropics today, there are places with low soil fertility, places where most of the hunger exists today, and places where most of the biodiversity loss is occurring, places where we don't actually apply a lot of inputs. Maybe intensification plays a role. You can avoid deforestation. You can provide more inputs. Malawi is a really good example of where providing fertilizers to farmers has actually helped increase production, has helped increase livelihoods. But in the high-latitude regions like North America and Europe where we have these huge eutrophication problems, maybe some de-intensification of agriculture and maybe accompanied by small loss in production will not be so bad. These places are currently receiving excess nutrient inputs. The Royal Society in 2009 coined the term sustainable intensification, where they said maybe we can think about intensifying and using a diversity of approaches specific to crops, localities, and so on. And this is true. I think we don't have one silver bullet for the world. We have to think about different solutions in different places. And finally, there might be solutions in terms of managing the demand in terms of diets, fuels, and waste. For the next part of my talk, I want to return to just one of these solutions, thinking about organic agriculture. So a lot of people say, okay, the organic agriculture is the way forward, and that might solve all of these problems. So I want to turn to some preliminary results from one of my PhD students, Verena Seufert, who addressed the question of, can organic agriculture feed the world? It has fewer environmental implications. Her study was actually a reanalysis of a previous study by Catherine Badgley and colleagues from Michigan. What this previous study did was to test two principal objections to organic agriculture. There are lots of objections to organic, but one of the principal ones people always say is organic agriculture has low yields. So yes, you can go organic, but it's never going to feed the world. It doesn't have comparable yields. So they compiled around 300 different studies of organic versus conventional yields, and in their study, they found that organic yields are actually maybe slightly lower than conventional yields in developed countries. But in developing countries, intensive organic can actually increase yields. And so on a global scale, they actually found that organic agriculture can produce more food than conventional agriculture. But there was huge criticism of the study because they essentially threw in a bunch of data and looked at ratios without doing a really rigorous scientific study. The data they got were from gray literature and so on. So Verena, my PhD student, decided to do a kind of a more rigorous meta-analysis of organic versus conventional yield ratios. And we feel like by doing this, we have learned a lot more. First, we had to compile our own data because when we look back at the data that they collected, we found that we had to reject a whole bunch of their data because they, for developing countries, most of the studies they found were actually not organic agriculture. They used a system of rice intensification, for example, which from Asia, which is not really organic. And for developed countries, also, we found some of the data could not be used because it did not rigorously report all the scientific information necessary for doing a meta-analysis. So bottom line is we so far have collected about 70 different yield data for cereals, vegetables, roots and tubers, and oil seeds and fruits. And we also looked at, in more detail, at different categorical variables, farming systems, how the study was done, or what kind of management actually occurred. And we did a meta-analysis. I won't go into the details. I'll just jump right away to the results. That all of these graphs following from now on will show the ratio of organic to conventional yields. So the percentage change in organic yield compared to conventional yield. So there's a vertical line that shows a zero. And so if values are to the left, it shows that organic yields were lower than conventional yields. So for all crops, we found about a 20% lower organic yields compared to conventional yields. For cereals, also we found lower values. But for vegetables and tubers, we actually found that the mean, at least, was higher for vegetables and tubers with organic yields compared to conventional yields. This is interesting, but it's not conclusive because we had only 8 sample points, so we are now trying to work on increasing the sample points. But the study actually supports the intuition, which is that most organic agriculture today currently is focused on kind of niche products like vegetables and fruits. It's not really focused on growing cereals. And it's possible that you cannot obtain cereal yields high enough for feeding most of the world's population. And if you compare this to Badgley studies, we actually found that our organic yields were actually lower. Essentially, Badgley and colleagues overstated yields of organic agriculture for cereals, but maybe they understated it for vegetables and tubers. What the more interesting thing is to look in more detail at what are the differences when you look at some of the structural variables. We found that organic yields in on-farm trials were actually higher or were more comparable to conventional yields compared to experimental stations. And this, on first glance, was a little bit confusing. Why would experimental stations have lower organic yields? But I think in this case, it's a denominator that's the problem. So on experimental stations, conventional yields actually tend to be higher than on farm trails. But this is a good thing. So if you look at reality, which is farmers on the field, it's likely that you can actually get higher yields with organic agriculture. Although if you have a potential to increase conventional yields even more if you follow the same practices as in experimental stations. Then you look at organic farms itself and the different types of organic farms. And interestingly enough, certified organic farms show comparatively higher yields than, say, farms in transition or farms that just report organic standards. If you look at the type of manure that's being applied, again, we find that use of commercial organic fertilizer provides higher yields for organic crops compared to using animal manure or plant sources or mixed sources. So we tend to talk about organic in this kind of, as one homogeneous group, but the way organic farming is actually practiced can make huge differences in how we think about its role in global agriculture. And so just to conclude from that part of my talk, we find from our meta-analysis that organic cereal yields are considerably lower than previously found by Badgley and colleagues. So in a sense, the organic agriculture has a role, but maybe not as strong a role in terms of cereal production. But organic agriculture can actually play a role and were more comparable to conventional yields under certain conditions. When we were on on-farm trails, when they were used in certified organic farms, or when farms are using commercial organic fertilizer. These are just preliminary results. We are working on increasing the sample size to see if we can say anything more interesting. I think with that, I'll end my talk. Thanks.
We have time for one question.
I'm just curious, you talked a lot about yield. I'm wondering, and you might not have this figure, but what percentage of food that's produced is actually eaten?
Okay. The information on waste is really poorly known. The estimates that range from 25 to 50% of food is wasted. There was a review recently the Royal Society, Proceedings of the Royal Society, that tried to look at waste, and unfortunately the data they found on real surveys came from the 70s and 80s. It turns out that we don't have a lot of information for today. The broad general understanding is that in developing countries, most of the waste occurs in the field, while in developed rich nations, most of the waste occurs in your refrigerator. So.
One more question.
Hi. A couple of big corporations like Monsanto and Archer Daniel Midland are aggressively marketing hybrid seeds in the developing countries, which rely on agriculture more than anybody else. I'd like to know your opinion about this, because there was some time ago when there was an Asian carp fish was introduced in the Great Lakes, there was a huge uproar that it will destroy the biodiversity, will eat up all the other species. But what kind of negative effect, of course there is a negative effect because of the hybrid seeds that are being introduced into the developing nations' agriculture system, because it will destroy all the indigenous species of crops. Isn't it similar to introducing a predatory fish into a Great Lakes? And how do you see it?
I mean, there's no simple answer for that. I think it depends on the specific kinds of crops. There's a huge movement against GM in India, for example. When GM cotton was introduced in India, there was a huge uproar against it. But farmers decided to go ahead and plant GM cotton anyway. And one study that I know from UBC actually found that farmers overall benefited from GM cotton. In fact, it was farmers who went out who had a huge protest in New Delhi to try to get GM. They had a ban on GM cotton in India, and it was farmers who protested against it. And overall, when they did a look at the economics of the situation, they found that Monsanto gains about a third of the revenue from introducing GM, while the farmers were benefiting in terms of two-thirds of the revenue. They argued that GM plays a role in terms of improving farmer livelihood and definitely yields. Yields have increased by four or five times. On the other hand, all of the issues associated with GM, the uncertainty in terms of the long term, I think they stand. So I don't have a simple answer for that.
Thank you very much, Navin.